Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is sound designer and composer Diego Stocco. But first of all, I want to talk to you about the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998. And I'm sure you've been reading a lot about artists and record labels that are against it and have written a big petition to Congress in order to get it revised. Now, what people don't understand about the DMCA is the fact that when it was first implemented, its primary reason for being was to criminalize the act of trying to get around digital rights management. Now, digital rights management, or DRM, is what was used on early downloads, on DVDs, on DVD audio discs, and it was an anti-copying measure. The problem was everybody hated it. And basically what you had was a consumer backlash. So DRM kind of fell by the wayside. But another thing that was in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was something called a safe harbor. What that meant was a service like YouTube couldn't be held liable if somebody uploaded a video that had illegal content on it. So in other words, if you have a user that decides they're going to put together a lyric video for the latest Taylor Swift song and they upload it, YouTube cannot be held responsible, or any other platform for that matter. If somebody uploads something with illegal content, the platform is in a safe harbor, so to speak, and they basically wash their hands of the whole thing. Now, basically, the way this works is, if you find out that somebody has illegally uploaded your content, because of the DMCA, you can send them a letter and what they call a takedown notice, and you can basically say, you must take this down or allow me to advertise on it, allow me to monetize it. And that's what Content ID does. Content ID is the way that you find out on YouTube if somebody has illegally uploaded your copyrighted material. And if that happens, it allows you to also send them a notice, DMCA notice. But what that does is it washes the hands of YouTube. And that's what everybody is upset about, because YouTube can't be held liable. And this is such a big job that record labels have a division just to track illegal uploads. And they still can't do it quickly enough, because they'll take down 10 and 12 will pop up the next day. Most of it is just very innocent. It's just fans that will put up a version of a song that they can lip sync over, or a lyric video, or they'll use it as music for their cat video. It's very innocent, most of it. Some of it is put up there to make money, and people will monetize it. And of course, if that's happening, then neither the record label or the artist is making any money. So that's what everyone is really upset about. And now we have this petition that's going to Congress, and there's a lot of heavyweight superstars on it: Taylor Swift, U2, Springsteen, Elton John, Paul McCartney, and about 20 others that have signed on, as well as the major record labels, asking that Congress revise the DMCA. Chances are that won't happen. And it won't happen primarily because there's really no leader that represents the artist. There's no association. There's no union. There's a union for everything else in the music business. Songwriters are covered. The record labels are covered. But artists aren't covered. And there's no one directly looking out for their interests. And until they get somebody who's well-respected by everybody and can put on a suit and go to Capitol Hill and plead the case, the chances are long that something like this is actually going to be changed. But anyway, keep watching in the news. Anytime you see the DMCA, now you know what it's about. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new Brand Your Music Crash Course, as well as my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Next thing I want to talk about is the fact that there's a very famous studio in New York that's about to close. MSR, or Manhattan Sound Recording, is about to close. It's a shame because it's one of the biggest studios in that it's like 14,000 square feet, has some of the largest tracking rooms in New York, maybe the largest actually. And so many people have recorded there. So many famous people have recorded there. And since it's right next door to Broadway, all the Broadway soundtrack albums are generally done there. It's not closing for the reason that most recording studios close, though. Yes, rent is sky high, but MSR has plenty of business, so that's not the problem. It turns out the big problem is construction that's happening next door. And for the last couple of years, MSR has been trying to work around the construction, but it's getting more and more difficult because the construction is lasting until 11 o'clock at night. And no matter what they do, the jackhammers can be heard through the walls. So they thought that once this building finishes up later in the year, they'd be free, only to come to find that another building next door on the other side is going to be built, and that's going to be 3 years in the making. So basically, MSR has given up and is closing. Now, don't cry too hard for this, because it's only going to be temporary in that once the studio is decommissioned, it's going to be moved someplace else. The owners don't know where yet. The owners don't even know if they're going to keep the same name, but they know that as soon as the studio is ready to go, they're going to go someplace else. In the meantime, about 25% of the capacity for large orchestral dates is going to go down the drain in New York. And the real problem with that is the fact that right now there are fewer and fewer places. And New York has just passed something called the Empire State Music Production Credit, which is an incentive. It's about 25% that you can get back in a credit, in a tax credit, if you keep your business in New York State. So it's kind of an inopportune time for this to happen, but nonetheless, that's the way it goes, and it goes especially hard in New York. My guest today is Diego Stocco, who's a sound designer and composer for movies like Takers and Sherlock Holmes, for television shows like The Tudors and Moonlight, and video games like Assassin's Creed. Diego's designed and programmed sounds for the Korg Z1 and Spectrasonic's Atmosphere, Omnisphere, and Trillion. He also creates his own musical instruments and has used both a tree and a burning piano in his pieces. I spoke with Diego via Skype from a studio just outside of Los Angeles. Tell me about when you first started. You started as what, a piano player? I'm not sure what your main instrument is, your first instrument is.
Well, as a kid, my first contact with an instrument was a Bontempi hip organ. It was essentially one of those little, instrument with reeds. It sounds like an accordion a little bit.
Yeah.
And then when I was 9, I started studying piano with a classical teacher. And then, you know, other things happened in the meantime. I started playing with a keyboard. It was a Yamaha keyboard that had a little bit of filters, a little bit of envelope. So I started becoming familiar with the idea of a synthesizer in a very rudimentary way, obviously.
Yeah.
Then I found one day a little keyboard that could sample. And so sampling became another thing.
How old were you at that point?
I was probably 10 or 11 when I saw the first keyboard, and then probably 12 when I saw this other little sampler thing. It wasn't just a toy, but it could sample 3 seconds of sound. But I remember one day I wanted to create that power chord hit thing that you could hear on songs. So I blasted classical music in my bedroom, press record, and recorded that thing. And it was kind of an achievement, you know, because
yeah.
I was the first, my first sampling technique. And I was proud that I was able to make it, you know.
What's the story about the violin cut in half? I saw on your bio there.
Yeah, so when I was 11, I went to the conservatory back in my hometown in Rovigo. I wanted to do piano. I wanted to study piano, but I wasn't good enough, and there were already too many people applying for piano. So they told me, you could still make it, but you have to pick a different instrument, and that you can do piano as a complementary instrument. So I did two more tests for violin and clarinet, and they picked me for violin. Problem was that I hated the violin. I couldn't really understand the technique with the bow, and I was just making some very bad sounds. And on top of that, when you do piano as a complementary instrument, the teacher wasn't really interested. So I wasn't studying, and I was having this battle with the violin teacher. So one day, after, you know, forgetting the books, forgetting the bow, forgetting the violin, I had to take a drastic measure. And so I put the violin in a vise, and I just saw it in half with a hacksaw, put it back inside the case, went to the school, and I told the teacher there has been an accident with my and he went, "What kind of accident?" So I opened it, I go, "Well, this is what happened." And said, "I'm gonna tell you right now, you're gonna be expelled by in a couple months, you're done with us." And I go, "All right, that sounds good to me." And so they kicked me out the first year. Obviously not just because of the violin, I wasn't doing that well. But yeah, that's the story, basically.
Hey, but you can tell everyone you went to conservatory.
Oh, for a year. Oh, yeah. No, but then I kept studying with a private teacher. But yeah, that first year was pretty intense. Yeah.
Well, I know I went to Berkeley as a student, and then I became a teacher there. And the first year was the best. It felt to me like you learned the most in that first year. And after that, you kind of specialized. But it wasn't nearly as interesting, and I didn't find it as intense as that first year, where there was just so much that was new and different. And when I go back and I talk to people that have also gone through the experience, they would say the same thing. Yeah, the first year was the best, you know, in terms of what you learn. So I don't know if that's similar, but that's the way it worked for me.
Maybe, but yeah, I would think that going to Berkeley would be a different kind of experience, because every year you are exposed to different things, more complex tasks that you learn. But it's interesting to know. To me, the conservatory was a way to see I'm not really part of this world. I there are things that I really love, because I still love the classical music world in general, but I've never been able to be part of it as a classical player.
Yeah. Okay. So how did you make the jump from being a player to a sound designer?
Well, that was something that happened gradually and not in a planned way. Because so after I studied for a few more years with a private teacher, the same teacher asked me to go teach kids at the elementary school where he was the director there. So I was teaching piano, keyboard, choral singing, but I wasn't really making enough money. So at that point, you know, my father, he's a butcher. He said, "Listen, you have two options here. You either make it on your own, or the shop is waiting for you." And I didn't want to be a butcher. So I just scrambled and started looking around for options. And I found a radio station that had a little post-production studio that was making commercials for the local market. And so I gave him a call and say, "Hey, I play instruments. I know a couple things. Can I come and see?" And they go, "We don't really need anybody right now. But hey, if you want to come and see what we do, fine." Day after, I was there. And for 3 months, I was going every single day. And I learned Pro Tools, because the guy was using Pro Tools at the time. We were at Pro Tools 3 back then. And so I was learning just by looking at it. And then I was helping with the settings, sometimes helping with the mic and things like that. One day, the guy quits. And so the owner goes, "Hey, do you have any idea what to do here?" I said, "Are you kidding me?" "I can start right now." And so I did. I started that day. And then because they were a production studio for radio, sometimes they needed a little sound effect here and there to, you know, cut from a commercial to another. So I started experimenting with the Eventide, you know, and getting the classic radio effects. Then there was another studio that I went working with for a couple of years, and that allowed me to specialize even more in creating these little things. And at the time, I was also doing jingles for radios, because I could do, you know, both sound effects and music. And I was using Spectrasonics products at the time. You know, there were a few out there already, and I, you know, they always struck me for being very high quality, very inspirational. And so after that, I kind of had a couple years where I was being a freelancer, I went to work to different small studios, but then I wasn't really doing much. I wasn't happy, and so I thought, what if I create a demo of a possible sound design sample library, and I send it to Spectrasonics and see what happens. So I did it. I created this concept. There was a cinematic thing with grooves and ambiences together. And I asked permission. At the time, Eric Persing was responding to emails, and he said, sure, why not? So I sent it in, and he loved it. He told me, I never heard anything like that. I would like to talk to you. Next time you come to the States, let me know. So first of all, I didn't even speak English that well. I was using translators to just figure out. And I've never been to the States. So it was like, oh, yeah, sure. Let's say September. So in September we meet. And I was very excited. I said, listen, I have this idea. It's fantastic. And he goes, no, I love it. But we are no longer doing samples of this. And I go, what? But you guys are so good. He goes, well, there's something else in the works. And so after a couple of days, they told me that they were starting to transition into virtual instruments. So he said, we are going to split the stuff that you created into two different products. One was going to become Atmosphere, you know, for the ambiences.
Yeah.
And the other one later on was going to become Stylus RMX.
Wow.
And so, yeah, that was the first material that I created back then for these two Spectrasonics products. And then obviously we did more. But at that point, I kind of thought, okay, now I think I am really getting a hang of this thing of called sound design, you know. And obviously I learned a lot being in touch with Eric, you know, and his team and everybody, you know. It was such a big change from Italy, coming from Italy to being at the center of, you know, sound design, sample creation.
Did you move shortly after that to the States?
No, I kept doing back and forth for a few years. I was coming here. And I moved here in December 2007. So 7 years after the first time we met. Yeah.
Whenever you move anywhere, it's a big transition. But when you move from your home country to a place that's foreign, that it's a different language,
everything is different.
How did that work for you then? That's such a big decision. Did you feel that you had to make that move?
Yeah. I wasn't doing terribly bad in Italy. I was working. I was working on a lot of different things. I was lucky enough to work with this producer in Italy. He was a jingle maker, music for commercial, great guy. And so we became very good friends. And we did a lot of good stuff together, but I felt like I was being pulled more into here, into the States, with the projects that were happening here. And I started learning, you know, I started meeting other people. I was working with Paul Haslinger, you know, the film composer. So he was getting me involved in films and things like that. So at some point I thought, I gotta make the jump. This is the kind of thing that you do without really thinking too much. Because if you start thinking about what you're going to miss, most likely you won't be able to. Actually, there are people that sometimes write me, hey, how was your experience? I'm writing from Italy. I'm thinking to come over there. What do you think I will miss? I mean, you'll miss everything.
Yeah.
There's no way to not miss your family, food, friends, your way of life, the way things are in general. They're very different countries, you know.
Yeah.
But you got to forget about that. Otherwise, you won't be able to continue. You have to essentially come here and become part of how things work here.
I know. I did the same thing, although it's not as drastic because it's in the same country, but moving from the East Coast to the West Coast for me. And I didn't know anybody in Los Angeles. Zero. Yeah. But I knew I had to make the move. There was only four places that I could go if I wanted to do well. And that was Nashville, New York, and I was already in the East Coast. I had enough of that. London or Los Angeles. Yeah. And for me, it was Los Angeles because, well, there was so much going on. It was warm.
There you go.
You know, I mean, there's so much. There's open arms saying, "Come to me." So, but again, it's a scary thing when you move, not knowing anybody, and having to overcome.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I was probably lucky that I also met other people, like Paul Haslinger, for example. He moved from Austria many years ago. So he told me, if you make it past the first year, most likely you're going to be able to continue. Because in his experience, a lot of people break before the first year. Maybe they don't make enough money, because obviously this is an expensive city. So you can come here with the best hopes in the world, but at the end of the day, you have to be able to make money to sustain yourself. And you don't have the support of anybody. You don't have family. You don't have a friend. So it's like you either make it on your own or goodbye.
Yeah.
You know? So that was the big difference.
Let's talk about your method for creating sounds.
Mm.
I've read a lot about what you say. It's pretty random and it's based on inspiration.
Yeah.
Does it just happen to you? Are you looking to do something and just looking around and saying, okay, let me try that? What happens?
Sometimes, yes, but I got into my mentality about creativity is that it cannot be a random moment. I mean, it can happen randomly, but you have to train yourself like an athlete. You have to train yourself to be ready to be creative. So you got to know the technology and you need to know microphone techniques and all. So if something happens and you also have the knowledge on how to record and process things, then you're in a good spot. But many things that I do are not planned, and those are usually the ones that give the best results. And the thing is, when you do just sampling, it's one thing, because there's a set of techniques. It's mostly about how to optimize the mapping. For example, you create a sample. Does it sound well when you're transposing it? But then I evolved from there because I started making music with trees, for example. And so that brought a whole different mindset. Like, okay, here I'm making music now. I'm approaching a tree like an instrument. How do I record it? I'm abandoning sampling. I'm moving into performing, you know?
Yeah.
And then those performances can also be reverted back to some sample form, but I was evolving into that, and you know, it was the trees, and then started building instruments. Once again, not something that I really planned, because I didn't train as an instrument maker. I was just curious to know what happens if I put these two things together and make a lot of noise with it. So, and then once again, you kind of figure out a technique. Okay, this is a lot of bass here, so maybe I can use this microphone and then I can process it this way. And so that thing became something else, up to the point where, you know, I built a lot of instruments, came up with different techniques to record trees, objects, places, and all kind of things.
What's your recording setup like? Because when people are doing traditional recording of bands, it's one thing that you do, and you have one set of criteria, but it's different for what you do, because you're approaching it from a completely different standpoint.
Well, it is somehow similar, but for example, the principle about using good preamps applies in both cases, because you always start with the best sound possible. So I have a API, I have 512Cs, and then I have EQ, compressor, and then I have Rode mics, which I've been using for so many years, because at the beginning, I knew that I was going to destroy something, and I didn't want to spend much money on the Neumann and expensive mics. So at the time, Rode was a brand new name. They had this stereo mic, the NT4. I thought, well, that looks interesting. So I bought that one, made a lot of stuff with it. And then I kept using them, and I realized they sound actually very good, and they make me feel at peace that if fire, water, and all kind of things happen to them, I can replace them.
Yeah.
And that has been the case, obviously, because all of those things happen to everything. So, yeah, I mean, I use good amps, good mics, and then and that's similar to recording bands, but the difference is that I also have a lot of different mics, like contact mics, pickups, and things that they don't sound necessarily that great, but they allow you to record sources that don't have much volume or are unusual sounding. So that's the main difference. You wouldn't use these things in a session because they're time consuming, number one, because you have to move them around to find the sweet spot. And they are not necessarily about quality. They can be about interestingness, you know. So is this sound interesting enough? Yeah. Is it the highest quality version possible? No, but it's not necessarily the point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
How many mics have you destroyed, do you think?
At least a dozen. I replaced capsules all the time. I have the NT5, the NT6, they use the same capsule. So I had to replace these capsules every, I don't know, 6 months or so, because I start to hear that the sound is going down. Or sometimes it's just a session that is very dramatic, and it just the microphone doesn't survive, essentially.
Where do you get your capsules from?
Rode has replacements. They have different types, so you can have the hypercardioid, the omnipolar, and so yeah, depending on what I want to record, I change them. Yeah, they.
Are you hip to this company called Microphone Parts?
Never heard of it.
It's microphone-parts.com.
Okay.
And they started by offering upgrades for all sorts of different microphones, and it was capsule upgrades and electronics upgrades for all sorts of inexpensive microphones.
Right.
And then they started to put their own kits together, so you can build for not that much money the equivalent of a U87, U47, you know. But check it out, because apparently their capsules are really good as replacements, and prices are fairly inexpensive as well.
So you can come up with your own design somehow? Let's say you can pick different parts.
You probably could. You probably could, yeah.
Because that would be interesting, you know, just to see, I don't know, create a microphone that has a very pronounced frequency range in a certain area, just to see how it works, you know.
Well, I guess that's important to you, because what you're recording, you have to tailor the microphone to the sound more than most engineers do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I mix, for example, things like Music from a Tree, from an engineering standpoint, it's a complete nightmare, because, you know, when you're recording a band, especially after these many years that techniques have been refined and optimized, you know what is the best placement for a guitar or a drums and things like that. But with a tree, it's like, where do you start? So, you start somewhere and you end up mixing this thing and you go, this is very interesting because there's a ton of noise. Maybe there's a very hollow frequency range right where there should be a bass. So you have to come up with an idea how to bring it back to life without making it sound terrible. So it's never just a pure mixing process. It keeps being a sound design process until the very end, you know, until you have it finalized. Yesterday, I actually started remastering my Music from a Tree, Bonsai, blah, 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 compositions, because I want to release them as an album, because I have them. And so I am remastering them with the UAD plugins.
Mm-hmm.
I have a nice chain that I built, and, you know, I'm bringing back the transients, making them a little better. And it's interesting because when I did them a few years ago, I thought they were sounding good, but now I can make them sound even better. So it kind of proves that this technique, it's not mature yet. And it's good because you can still learn new things in how to make these approaches to recording nature better.
How much are you layering sounds? And the reason why I ask you is a sound designer like Scott Gershon, for instance, is approaching things trying to make everything bigger than life. So there's lots of different layers, but it doesn't sound like that's your approach. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. In fact, my approach is try to make the sound as close to the source possible. So, for example, in Music from a Tree, people thought that it was sampling because they see me doing the action on the tree, but then they think, well, you know, he mapped stuff on a sampler and then he played it back. But that's not what happened, which is why the composition is relatively simple, because what I wanted to do was play the tree as an instrument and record the sound. So if I can get 5 notes out of it, so be it. I'm not going to extend the range artificially, and I'm not going to enhance the sound to make it sound like it's an actual violin, because there's no point, you know? So I record one thing. I think it sounds decent. I can obviously optimize the frequency a little bit to avoid being too screechy or, you know, too weird. But the idea is to keep the sound as it is, you know?
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. I see that you work with both Patrick Leonard and Dave Stewart.
Yeah.
What did you do for those guys?
Well, with Patrick, it was an interesting coincidence because we were both invited to speak at this event that they do in Santa Monica called Composer Salon. It's a quarterly event, or maybe every 6 months, and they invite different people. So I was one of the guys, Patrick was another one, and then there was a third person, which I forgot. But anyway, I did my presentation. And I didn't know about Patrick because I didn't even read the description of the other two people. Because I was just trying to figure out what am I going to do with this thing. So I went there actually with a twig and a contact mic to show them how it works. It was pretty weird,
yeah.
But they laughed and they loved it. And so Patrick, when Kubi is the host, said, and Diego also did the burning piano. And Patrick went, I'm never going to let you close to my piano.
Yeah.
So making jokes back and forth. And then Patrick goes on stage and Kubi introduces him and he goes, Patrick Leonard, he did this, Madonna, Elton John. I go, oh, okay. So that's who he is.
Yeah.
And he kept making jokes back and forth with me. And so after he finished his presentation, we had a chance to talk and he said, I think I tried a lot of things when it comes to production, but what you do is interesting because it feels like we can do it in real time, like real time experimentation between me, piano, you on whatever you want. And I thought, yeah, it is true. I guess we could try. And so we started recording together. He was he had a studio down at the Hanson place, mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Hollywood. He had his room with the piano and a lot of other things. And so we didn't really have an idea in mind. We're just saying, okay, I start in D. Okay. And then I'll follow. Or I start with a tree and you follow.
Yeah.
And then in real time, I was doing processing of his piano sound. And I was adding things with a light bulb, with the Xperi bass and all kind of other things. So we end up doing some pretty cool things, you know, like improvisational, but still very musical because he's an incredible pianist,
yeah.
And obviously a fantastic musician. But it was also the two of us, we kind of clicked, you know, when it was coming to, okay, now you're leading, now I'm following, then the role reverses. And then we started doing things with DTS, the surround company,
mm-hmm.
Because they were at the time introducing their Neo X surround technology, which was a 13.1. So we did the first project to showcase this 13.1 system. And then I kept doing other things with DTS. And then I think we also did the Neo X, which was the headphones version of the 13.1. And yeah, so that was, you know, we did a lot of other things, of course, in between. But pretty much that was the how it started. And Dave Stewart was also an artist that worked with DTS. They wanted to record a native video for Neo X. So it was filmed from a surround sound perspective, meaning that some of the choices in the scenes that we filmed were, you know, meant to help the sound to work well. So let's say we want to hear dramatic panning of an element from top left speaker to rear cent, I don't know, something like that. So we made sure that the angle was happening that way. And so I did the sound design for that. But it was music sound design because I was recording elements at the set, and I was also processing some of the elements from the song, which was every single night, you know. And so it was very cool. It was very nice to work with Dave. We had a very time on set, you know, and we were all very happy with the result.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it sounds very cool. Very cool. There's so much more I want to talk to you about, but I know we're running up against the schedule here. Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you've learned along the way?
Well, I can say what helped me, because I've seen the opposite approach working against the person who picked it. And so when I was basically learning the basic skills like engineering and things like that, I wasn't necessarily becoming an engineer. Same thing with the performing or playing. I didn't decide I am going to become this person or this type of professional. I just learned everything I could in every possible way. And I think that allowed me to, number one, stay in business and kept working because I could switch from one thing to another without, you know, saying, oh, I'm not really fit for that, because I knew the skills. So I did post-production, commercials, jingles, playing with bands, doing dance music, and then Pro Tools, heavy editing, heavy sound design. So I was able to just bring everything together. And I think that helped me a lot, because now I'm at the point where if I have an idea, I also have the tools, the knowledge to make it happen. So I would say keep an eye open. Don't make a decision too early in your life about what you want to become, because maybe you don't even know. So maybe you'll become something better, you know?
Yeah, yeah. To find out more about Diego, you can go to diegostocco.com. That's DiegoStocco, Diegostocco, one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.